Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. And we're going to be talking about Labor Day, and in the latter part of the show, we're going to discuss with Pedro the passing of a great magician, they say the greatest, Juan Tamariz. Who of Spain. Should be interesting. We're going to learn all about magic. I think most people are anxious to learn a few tricks, get by. Anyway, it's a big occasion. Yeah, I'll just say at the top while we're waiting to talk to Phil is that Labor Day is really something we ought to always be reflecting on why we have it and why in North America we don't share with the rest of the world, May Day. We'll get into that someday. But I believe we're joined now by Phil Conlon. Are you there, Phil?
Yes, hello, Phil. I am here.
Are you on a street corner among a million people, or where are you?
I'm not among a million people. I'm on Queen Street West, just west of Ossington.
Okay.
I'm marching with the Workers United Canada Council, the union that I work for. Mm-hmm. We have... We're very much towards the front, so I haven't yet had a chance to see what's behind me, but I was able to, at the time we were mustering, I was able to see quite a number of things, which is that some of the unions have a very nice turnout. Food and commercial, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I was just wondering, yeah, for who would they be, but you're already telling me, so
okay.
Yes, food and commercial.
Yeah, so the food and commercial workers who... they have two locals that represent supermarket workers, and they have a massive turnout, which is nice. And to remind us that the people who sell us our groceries have to struggle to make a living.
Yeah.
There is now the construction trades, not the laborers, they don't participate, but the different crafts who have colorful emblems and which go back to the 19th century, they were lined up on University Avenue to march behind us, and they have more of a disciplined way of walking than the rest of the unions. Bricklayers and carpenters, you know, unions like that. They do take it seriously. There's a cacophony of sound which I don't like, which is. Uh-huh. There's no marching bands or anything like that. There is electronic music blasting from speakers that are so loud that nobody can talk to each other, and it doesn't sound musical, and it doesn't particularly sound like a Labor Day.
Yeah. Do they sing labor songs?
If they do, I heard one small group singing "Solidarity Forever," and it kind of faded out. You know, it was.
When you say small group, you mean that was a live a group in the march, or is this recorded music?
No, it was a group in the march. Uh-huh. But I mean, maybe there were 24 people. It really didn't impress at all.
Do they have speeches at the beginning? Muster. I like that. That's a military term.
Right. There's no speeches at the beginning. At the beginning, they just tell you it's time to start walking down the street. we're very close to the front, and there's no particular parade marshal or parade chief leading it.
Uh-huh.
Let me mention my own group because I'm very proud of them. we have a very good sized group of workers from the Canada Goose Factory in Scarborough. We have about close to 100 of them. So we feel very good about that. One of the issues that is being featured is the strike by the Ontario Public Service Employees Union this strike is a couple of months old. It's against a number of social service agencies who have banded together and have kept their unity. And the strike is over. The workers want a 3% raise, and they're being offered 2%.
Boy, it never changes, does it?
Yeah.
3%. I mean,
yeah. Yikes. And I at this point, people are just wondering, maybe they should just wrap this thing up because they're not getting anywhere. And of course, if you can operate your agency with all of your unionized staff on strike for a couple of months, it's probably an opportunity for the bosses to figure out how they can do with less workers in the future. But it is one of the most difficult things is when you go on strike for this. And the answer of the bosses is, well, we get our money from the province and we just don't have enough money to pay you. That might be true, you know.
How about everybody strike against the government?
Yeah, well, that's... Huh. So, yeah, right.
They only provide 3% of leadership themselves.
Right. I mean, it's like... there's no great sense about just what a crisis this strike is presenting. I mean, it's a lot of employees of these agencies who do very difficult work, like working with high needs children mentally ill people and things like that. There's no sense.
There's a regular demonstration on Bloor near Dufferin. You must know that outfit. I see them and I honk at them. And
okay, so that's probably one of the agencies.
And you're right about tough work, because anyone who drives that part or walks that part of Bloor notices that there are very frequently ambulances and police, which tells you that would be a tough working environment.
Right. So I could also tell you that the Ontario Nurses Association has a very large delegation of nurses and a lot of young ones. So I was very happy to see that. And that's, of course, nurses have tremendous problems in dealing with the employers in this industry, because the purse strings are controlled by Doug Ford, who, one, likes to see their work privatized, and two, doesn't want to give them enough money to do their jobs properly.
Yes.
So I would say that they're very conscious of the dilemma that they face. And of course, everybody should be concerned when your nurses are being badly treated in the workplace.
Yes.
That is.
And if you happen to be ill, the deterioration of the workplace is bound to happen.
Absolutely. Now, there's a very, very large group, the largest I've seen so far, from the SEIU, and they represent hospital workers and people in nursing homes and retirement homes. And they've got more than 1,000. They may have 2,000 people here. That's really
that's very impressive.
Large. Yeah. But, you know, they're all people who are governed by a law that says they can never go on strike, that if they can't settle their differences at the bargaining table, then a bureaucratic nightmare starts with the Ministry of Labor.
Mediation.
And high-priced lawyers and ultimately arbitration. And so it's, I think maybe that's one reason why they turn out in such numbers.
Do they carry signs with a particular message, by the way, so that people understand what their problems are, or do they bring that kind of?
No, it's more of a patriotic show for their union. The union has colors, and you know they have their. But I did see one sign of one particular group who worked for a nonprofit and was carrying. It was a wanted sign for their executive director. They said wanted for. Abusing the workers, and we thought, well, that's very nice. I mean, but I was just like one sign of one person. But I thought we actually should have more of that. I mean, name the people. Because I was near the front before the march set off. Lana Payne of Unifor was giving an interview, and she was giving it to the mainstream press. Of course. those reporters are her members. And we don't see those reporters walking up and down and talking to the different unions on the parade. We never see them. And once they do their interview at the beginning, they disappear. One of Ford's cabinet ministers showed up, but we couldn't see where we kept an eye on him, but we didn't see where he disappeared to. But
you couldn't have arranged for him to have a meeting with those workers who have are asking for 3%.
Yeah, no,
it might have been helpful.
Right, that wasn't going to happen. Right, very, very much stage managed.
Yeah.
Anyway, what I'm going to do is step out of the march and look down Queen Street, and I have the SEIU behind me in their purple, and they stretch for several blocks from Abel Street all the way to Dufferin. So that's a very, very good turnout.
Yeah.
And they really deserve congratulations for that.
I want to ask you, I want to go back to, you mentioned, Lana, I do this all the time, leader of Unifor.
Lana Payne, yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to call her Turner, I don't know, I'm crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't understand, because Unifor is not a member of the OFL, are they? They're not a member of CLC. And the issue between them that years back, just to remind listeners, the Unifor was accused by the Labor Congress of raiding members of other unions.
Right.
And
it got so bad
that they had their own march. So are you saying that Unifor is in the march this year?
Well, they were last year. They were at the very back behind all of the Labor Council affiliated unions.
So where are they now?
So I can't see them because I'm towards the front. but that's probably where they are. But I do want to say that when Lana Payne was giving that interview with, cameras and everything like that, there was not a single Unifor identifier on anybody around. And yet I could just tell the way they were carrying it on that she's going to be on the news. And
it's sort of stealing the march, isn't it? Because
there
are outstanding issues. A lot of us are waiting to see this matter resolved.
Right.
You know, this is, they always call themselves the biggest private sector blah blah union.
Right.
And
yes,
that's important. But they got into quite a serious problem, and there is issue of, are they going to pay back dues for the years they were away? Are they going to, is there going to be an agreement not to raid each other?
Yeah, well, so far, none of that has happened. One continues to hope. Somebody wants to say hello to me.
Oh, go ahead.
How are you? I'm glad you're here. So I'm on a radio interview right now.
So I was greeting one of my members, a local president that I hadn't seen earlier. So that was nice.
Yeah. We won't be opportunistic and ask to speak to them, but I'm glad. That's a good sign. The leaders are there. Terrific. So now, we would like everybody to have a good march. And you point out it's a large one, which tells us that people are unhappy with the economy, unhappy with the political leadership, I guess. But who has responsibility for organizing? Because you raise the issue. It sort of goes by union by union. Some unions are well organized when they come and some are not. Whose job is it to put the whole thing together?
Well, I think Labor Council, that's their responsibility. And I think they do a very good job in terms of just marshaling it, getting it off on time, keeping the parade together so you don't have these huge gaps in it where, people fall out of the parade. But I don't know how they decide who's going to be at the front, who's going to be in the middle, who's going to be in the back.
Yeah. Why can't they make decisions about, for example, guaranteeing there will be labor songs that are sung or slogans common signs, which you see when you see demonstrations in Europe, most places of the world,
Right.
It's clear that somebody has gone to a lot of trouble to make it a discipline, you know, impressive looking march.
Right, right. Well, that would be a European May Day, not a Canadian Labor Day. That would be the difference. You know?
Yes.
And yes, that is very striking. It's nice of you to show up if you show up. If you don't show up, okay, that's fine too. You know, that's the attitude I think we have here.
Yeah.
And we find that a lot of people are reluctant to come out because they think it's a long weekend, but they sometimes forget where the long weekends came from, you know, and how much people had to struggle to get them, you know.
Yes.
So that is something we have to do. I have to say, by the way, I want to give a shout out for some mental health workers in my own union. These are people who worked a 12-hour shift and got off at 7 o'clock this morning and came out in March.
Ooh.
So we're very proud of them. And we think actually that is the spirit that we would like to see more of, right?
In that area, are there specific signs reflecting grievances, or are they just the name of the union?
Just the name of the union and a slogan, whatever, you know, respect for workers, justice for all, things like that. There's, of course, no signs that I've seen about, hold on a second. Sorry, I'm going to put you on mute for a second.
Yeah, go ahead. This is, by the way, if anyone want to know, this is Taylor Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM, and I think Phil is back. Are you back?
I'm back, yeah.
Great. Thank you. This is live, coming from the streets of Toronto.
Yeah, so we're now going under the Parkdale Railway underpass and coming up on Dufferin Street, and then we're going to turn, and people are going to go into the CNE. Now, my understanding is that there may be a rally inside the CNE. I don't know. I won't be there.
There may be? Nobody knows?
Well, nobody I've asked knows. You know. Okay, so I'm now in a place which is too noisy. I'm going to drop out from my group, and I'm going to watch the parade. Pedro... You want to have Pedro call me back in about 10 minutes?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We'll talk to you soon, Phil. We're getting a live report. Phil Conlon. Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Phil has a show, by the way, Classical Underground, Wednesday, 6 to 8 p.m. And he's giving us a Classical Underground report on the Labor Day March. I wish there was more of this, where you actually get into it, because we need to not only be celebrating, but we need to be talking about how we celebrate and how we mark, and are there messages. I would think the Labor Council and OFL and CLC, Unifor, all of them should be at the top of the list. Shouldn't be to say we're a union and we're here. There should be to say here's our issues with our employer, here's our issues with the government of the employers who run Ontario or run the whole of Canada. They need to, that should be primary, I would think. And I'm glad we're able to do this on the Taylor Report, talk about the problems, not only what's going great, what we should celebrate, but also things that need to be addressed. Clearly, it needs to be somebody addressing the issue of creating a disciplined march with agreed upon primary slogans. And there needs to be, the reason we have labor songs and great music, by the way, we have some, I think, we're going to play, but that should be the prevailing, I would argue, maybe it's probably somebody else would have a different position, but I already wouldn't, for example, put forward just any type of broad cultural music. We could try to specifically reflect the labor movement, but some of the greatest songs were based on the issues of hours, of danger, of work, the way employers workers are cheated out of living income and that sort of thing. But I guess I'm saying more thought should go into it, I think it's helpful to talk about, well, whose job is it to put the thing together? I think we have Solidarity Forever, the song. We won't play it just yet, but one of the obvious points it has to be raised in is there are differences, heavy, serious differences in the labor movement. They've been glossed over. And this issue of Unifor not being a member of the Canadian Labor Congress, but the media, and you have to ask, why does the mainstream media treat Unifor as though it is the labor movement? There's something a little odd about that. And Lana being the one being interviewed, every sector of the economy has major unions, and they have issues, and they're not the same as those of Unifor. But the issue of rating is absolutely, it's like some kind of, poison in the blood system. If you tolerate it, you're going to destroy any possibility of solidarity. But this is the Taylor Report at the CIUT. It's 89.5 in FM in Toronto. And if Pedro is agreeable, we will play a song from the Travelers called Solidarity Forever. Is that ready? Thank you.
Union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run. There can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
It was we who plowed the prairies, built the cities where they trade, dug the mines and built the workshops, endless miles of railroad laid. Then we stood outcast and starving, mid the wonders we had made. But the union made us strong.
They have taken untold millions that they never toiled to earn. But without our brain and muscle, not a single wheel could turn. We can break their haughty power, gain our freedom when we learn that the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong. In our hands is placed a power greater than their hoarded gold, greater than the might of atoms magnified a thousandfold. We can bring to earth a new world from the ashes of the old. For the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
It's the Taylor Report, CIOT. 89.5 FM in Toronto. We'll be talking again with Phil Conlon live at the Labor Day March, and we could talk about all these issues. A major one in my mind, we want to remind everybody that labor doesn't just have to think about, the one-on-one or the mano-a-mano with the employers, but they also need to develop a voice about how society is organized and disorganized or undermined by private capital, which dictates the terms of practically everything. We have, fortunately now, once again, a socialist voice leading the NDP, which is they've gone through an interesting transformation. I wonder if they're present today. I don't know what obvious, doing it obvious. Obviously, you resurrected the language of socialism, which was largely destroyed, undermined by the Tony Blair approach, all having to do with the collapse of the socialist cause, you could say, which is labor's cause as well. And as a matter of fact, it's labor that produced the socialist movement. Because of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the surrender of the social democratic leaders to capital, we went through a whole period where we were told, actually, NDP, for example, did not use the word socialist. They didn't use the term working class. Clearly, there's something going on beneath the leadership that has caused this. And we've seen the shock, actually, within capitalist culture that people turn towards, people like the most outstanding name of Mamdani of New York City, when he had, according to all the mainstream media and the Democratic Party and everybody, he had less than 2% support when he put his name in to become the mayor. But when people heard what it was that he was prepared to do, and when he said he was a socialist and he believed in solidarity with the working class. By the way, he put himself personally on the line. He once went through a fast joining taxi drivers in New York. I don't know the details, but I know that he put himself on the line, that is, did without food for a few days or however long it was. But the taxi drivers loved him, and working people of New York and around the country admired this individual. And he proved, he went, they say, oh, you only have 2% support. Well, the reason for that is that the mainstream media makes sure they don't tell anybody what you're saying. But once he got himself in the contest, got himself in front of people and said what he had to say, they moved to him. And this is happening across North America, actually, particularly in USA. The Americans are just falling down shocked. Certainly the media, who they think they really must control thought. They're proud of it, actually. They can't believe that masses of people are turning towards those who promise shorter work weeks, more wages, opposition to militarism and commitment to education for all, and at a time when our capitalist class, particularly in the form of Trump, they're running in the opposite direction, where they want to deprive working people of education, higher education in particular, and. There's no question, there's more oxygen being pushed into the system. And these labor marches and all that, this should be at the forefront. And everybody should remind workers and their organizations that they have a duty to speak out on issues. And I'd say the major one, for example, is, Do we have a government committed to peace? Because the working class really doesn't care to be chewed up by those who think war is good, war is healthy. There's an old slogan, right? What is it? War is basically the health of the capitalist system. I think we're joined again by Phil Conlon. Is there, Phil?
Yes, I'm here.
What do you know? We got you on a street corner. Now you're the observer. Have you learned anything since we spoke to you?
Well, I mentioned that the SEIU healthcare unit was very, very large. I got to see how large it was, and it was well over 1,000 people. SEIU has another local, which they call Justice for Janitors, and their task is representing those people who clean office buildings, which is a very difficult job to represent, because the way labor laws work, these contractors get a contract, you get it organized, and then they lose the contract you got to go back and organize them all over again. So that's it. That's their Justice for Janitors campaign. It's and they have a very nice turnout from their local. I would say about 100 people or 125 people. So,
And what's the union again?
That's SEIU.
SEIU.
Yeah. Just, so it's a different. Yeah, and it's Justice for Janitors. And
I'll bet you could go. You could probably use that term, and you'd find them, right?
Absolutely. And they are. They're always organizing, and it's running to stay in place. Because as soon as they get a collective agreement, some real estate company that kicks the contractor out, and yes. Then they got to hire the next group. I'm just walking under the railway overpass, very loud.
Well, we really appreciate it, Phil. That we can tell the, as Phil says, it's a loud crowd.
Okay, so the group I'm passing now is Unite, who represents hotel workers. And again, I just got a comment that it's the women doing the heavy lifting. It's mostly women workers in that group, which isn't surprising. I'm go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah. We're probably going to have to let you go. One last thing. So you go through the gates and they let you watch the air show and have cotton candy. Is that your reward for the month?
Well, yes, except there's not really an air show, it doesn't appear, which is I'm very happy about. But you can definitely have the cotton candy. And
by the way, do you have to be in the unions to get through the gates?
No, they give us passes, which we hand out at the beginning of the march. Or some unions withhold them until people have gotten to the end, right? So, but that's how you get in. If you show that pass, you get your free admission.
So you have to be organized labor to go to the labor march, or to get into X.
Well, no one's going to stop you from participating.
Mm-hmm.
But
you need a pass to get in.
Well, you would need one, so you'd have to find one of the unions.
And we have to arrange that workers get to go into the X for nothing on Labor Day, for crying out loud.
Well, I think that's a good goal.
Why should you have to be in a union? You're a worker, aren't you? And you don't even have the benefit of a representation.
But,
and so you have to stand outside and look through the fence at the other guys.
Or you have to pay. That's right. absolutely.
Hey.
So.
Yeah. Phil, I have a proposed slogan, you know.
Okay.
Solidarity, they say the union makes us strong. We make the union strong. I think we ought to turn that upside down. People better learn that you want a healthy union, you better take it over.
Okay. That's the best thought of the day, Phil. I'm going to let you go with that.
Yeah. Hey, well, thank you very much, Phil. It's been exciting. Thank you.
It is. Okay. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay. Bye-bye. That's Phil Conlon. He's a classical underground, and he's kind enough to share with us the live experience of being at Labor Day. But I got to say, I worry for the labor movement. I hope everybody does. By the way, my father was a janitor for a period of time, and I used to go at night and help him sweep. So you can learn a lot being a janitor about class and such things. I can remember that it being dark and banging the doors to make sure they were all locked and all that stuff. And it's true. They people should go to Justice for Janitors. You know, we should all learn. Well, every union ought to have a key slogan for this moment in their work experience, and convey that to everybody else, and have sites like Justice for Janitors. I'll bet you can find them, and you should support them. We heard about the SEIU union. It really needs support for the workers in their sector. So this is Labor Day, and we're laboring. I think we've covered most of the thing. I will remind. Oh, there is something happened in the OFL. I mentioned quickly. There was a proposal that the OFL should, which meets every 2 years, should meet every 3 years. And I just have to say that it clearly, this is something organized labor people who belong to unions should be vehemently opposed to, because what that would mean is the bureaucracy of labor, and it does exist, they want more and more space between them and the members. But if you have a meeting, OFL used to meet every year. I think they should still meet every year. They will say, oh, it's too expensive. Whatever happened to sharing quarters? How about everybody say, well, we're in unions together. We're struggling together. We don't have money to get the fanciest hotel. Let's get one that isn't. Let's stop making going to the OFL meeting a few days off for some guys to spend time at sitting around with their chums. Let's make it, we have urgent matters. Every year, it seems, it's almost, in terms of, let's get some leadership, you have to be talking about things. Policies come in rapidly from the employers, and from the provincial, from the federal, and from the local governments. Issues that really damage the interests of labor. So you have to be meeting regularly, and you actually have to be debating them. And don't send the guy who is a staff rep. Send the actual employee who is being hurt, who has a crying need and need of solidarity. Send those people. And if you have frequent meetings, they will go. And actually, they won't expect to treat it like a holiday. We're past that, I think. We're starting to see, we need to wake up. We're back to the expression wake up, which is a favorite one amongst anybody trying to organize a movement. This is the Taylor Report, CIUT, 89.5 FM. And we promised earlier, and we wanted to make sure we do it, talk to Pedro about this great magician. We need more magicians at this point, particularly in the labor movement. His name is Juan Tamariz. Have I got that right, Pedro?
Tamariz.
So I managed to mispronounce right off the bat. Tamariz.
Most people do.
Tell us about him. He just died, and apparently the world, those who loved magic shows, card tricks, and all those, there's a great... As always, from the beginning of time, it's been people love these guys, and he was about as good as it gets. Is that right?
As good as it gets, and even better. It's a great point, Phil. And thanks again for your respect on the whole art of magic. And Juan would have definitely been happy with that whole idea, because it is an art, and this is something he was so passionate about, to become the greatest magician in the world in modern times. Yes, he was mostly famous for his card work, bringing together people, but I guess it was the feeling and joy and entertainment value that really brought him to the top. So absolutely, this man was very, very special.
Well, now he's from Spain, but he's known around the world. He performed North America, so he had mastery of languages, right? How many languages did he speak?
Oh, probably he could speak every language in the world.
I watched him. You provided a YouTube and a version. People should watch him. He not only, when he was speaking English, he was speaking rapidly, and I would say colloquial English, and very inventive. So not only did he have a mastery of cards, but he had a mastery of how to communicate. It's really a wonder to watch him. Let me ask you about this. You say he, and apparently it's a consensus that he was the greatest card magician of his time. He had comedy, a lot of comedy in his almost every phase of his tricks. He was doing comedy that makes you laugh out loud. Is that seemed to me that would be a rare gift.
a very rare gift. He loved people. He loved entertaining. This was a passion inside him, who he was. And he would explain to this, you know, all of us have different sorts of characteristics. Some magicians may be very, very serious, and other magicians might be a little bit more comical. But Juan was a very, very unique character. He loved people. He loved transmitting this idea of how much he loved life. And he felt that that communication, that connection with people, he wanted people to vibrate with that type of energy, that type of fun.
Yeah. What was his, when you watched him, what was it that you saw in him? Well, let me put it, maybe I put it this way. Is it possible to speak of his best tricks? Or the, and is tricks the right word I'm looking for?
Yeah, his show, I would say his show, you know, the way he would do it, he would start the show sometimes, and talking about humor, Phil, going back to that topic, he believed that humor was a way to join people. So when you walked into a crowd, you know, people would come to see him, and perhaps, you know, they're coming to see him, but they weren't connected. And so his idea to start a show of coming up with some gags and some fun, and everyone would be ha 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 and start laughing, and that would join the group together. So he used humor as a real weapon, if you want to say, to join people together. So he used it intentionally, but that's also who he was.
Yeah. Yeah, I got his, again, I thought of, I've seen on television and in live performances the old idea of the, particularly if it was cards or balls or little, or, you know, like the magicians who use hands, their hand tricks, there was usually a kind of an elegance about them. They dressed elegantly and they had a certain suave language, and they would be moving their hands, and amazing things would be going on in front of your eyes, and they would almost pretend they didn't notice. But in his case, he puts on a shiny green jacket or a red hat. The hat changes size, you know, as he's talking. He puts it under his arm, and it becomes a different type of hat. I mean, that is a rather. I wonder if the other magicians. He had to be in a minority using that technique.
Well, I think the hat's a very, it's a hat in the magic is a very, very symbolic thing. And many, many magicians used it. And yes, his colors of his hat were like this bright green and this purple hat. So he loved the hat, right? I think it was also because, you know, he would sometimes take off the hat and give a little bow and then put his hand on top of his bald spot.
Yeah.
So he was just a real character this way. But he, when it came to skill, and Phil, when you mentioned about skill, he had skill second to none with his hands, what he could do and his skills. So this was amazing as well, that he had the humor, he had the love, he had the passion, he had the entertainment, he had the language, as you mentioned, and he also had what they call in magic the chops, what he could do with 52 pieces of paper.
Yeah. Did you see him work in the flesh? Did you ever see him live?
Yep. Yeah. Yes, I did.
Where did you see him, and what was it like?
It was very, very special. It was like meeting a king, you know. It was meeting royalty. So
I remind everybody, Pedro is Pedro Paquero. You can find him pedropaquero.com. So we're talking to a pro here. And so you as a pro were watching him. Where were you, and what was it like?
Yeah, you know, and I think watching is an interesting word. You know, we have this discussion in magic a lot of times. It is an involvement. So there is a phrase that says spectators don't exist. So you want to have an attitude of like, you know, we're all sharing this moment. So I was involved. I would say I was submerged, if you want to say so. I was watching, yes, but I was really involved. This was in Spain at his house. And so it was quite an imagine. There was about 10 or 15 of us in the room when this was happening. So
you were in a small gathering of. He knew you guys. You yourself were a do cards. That's your main performance, right?
Amongst, you know, we were all students. So there were some professionals there that the best in the world, and then there was a group of us who were students.
Yeah. So. That's really a privileged situation. You were 15 in the room.
Maybe less. Yeah, about 10. Yeah.
I like the expression you say that the observer, who doesn't exist, you perform as though there's no one there?
Yeah, there's a phrase by another magician and he came out with a book, and it was named The Spectators Don't Exist.
The Spectators Don't Exist. That's it. psychologically, for someone performing, that's very good comment. But to reach that zone, by the way, you have to be very confident of what you're doing.
That comes with the practice and the constant passion. And Juan, you know, his time schedule was interesting, that he would get up around 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and then he would be up all night and then go to bed around 7 in the morning, 8 in the morning. So that was his...
This may explain why he had 5 wives.
Yeah, so, you know, and you would have to go along to meet his schedule, obviously, right? So he would, a lot of his shows in Spain would begin at 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, really? After the Spanish would have dinner, they would go to see a show, and sometimes his shows would start at 1 in the morning.
You know, that's very interesting you should mention it. I just read a piece in the New York Times saying that that Spanish culture is starting to move away from the late night meal, which is part of the tradition. Maybe it's not all of Spain, maybe some regions, but having a late dinner and then watching, you know, somebody has a curious idea about time.
Juan created such a respect for magic. Sorry, Phil, going back to this idea about Spain, and that he rose to the top in Spain, and he is so well known in Spain as a star, as a someone of very, very special caliber of entertainment, magic, and just building groups. So Spain is so proud of Juan and what he did. The whole world is. Anyone who knows Juan, or have met Juan, or knows about Juan's magic and will be influenced by him going forward. Very, very special.
Juan Tamariz.
Yes.
he faced the challenge of television, because they say, television is going to be the ruin of magicians, because the idea was, we can catch them. But he actually embraced it, right? He was one of those who said he liked to do close-up magic. That is, whereas our intuition would say, don't do that. But he took that on, and he and other magicians said, yo, get as close as you like and see what happens.
Yes, and there's many clips of him performing on TV. He could literally bring a crowd of 100 people who were watching, who were live in the studio, right to their feet. So it was such an experience. So people would be watching television, and they'd be experiencing the magic that he was doing and watching, how is he doing that? What's happening? Getting involved in his story and his passion, but then also the people who were interviewing him, the people who were running the show, the cameramen, the live audience who was part of the show would be jumping up and down and, oh my God, so watching their reactions. And it was a memorable experience. That was his first job, by the way, in the early 70s.
His first job was what? I'm sorry.
Working on TV.
Yeah.
Now, interesting as well, that was near the end in the 90s. He realized that there was a shift in people's attention, and that more and more and more, they wanted him to do quicker and quicker and quicker tricks. So do something really fast, make it amazing, and very, very visual. And that wasn't necessarily his style. So he realized that...
He had to change. As great as he was, he had to adapt to that.
He walked away from that idea of television because he could see that the idea of, you know, half hour, hour shows...
The squeeze of the time, yes. Unless they give you an entire time. Just to bring you out, you know, the way they do it, that is, I can see. Actually, other performers have the same problem. Anybody talking about literature, anybody who has a particular form of comedy, if you put them in a tight time frame, you're actually robbing them of they have to set the material up, right? And if they can't do that, you're kind of left with a dissatisfaction, or the people feel shortchanged. They don't really get to see what a guy like Juan Tamariz is about.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, Phil. It's so true. When you think about how talented Juan was, if you're going into a TV show, you're going to perform, you might say to the director, okay, look, don't have the camera over here. I don't want someone over my shoulder looking this way. I don't want that, you know, see, but he was so good, basically, he would just say, look, you just film me and everyone's going to have a great time.
Yeah. I might know, we're talking to PedroBaquero.com. Please go and check him out. He's a real deal. I assume you can spell Baquero, P-A-R-K-E-R.com. Pedro, everybody can spell that. Watching him, and I really did enjoy it. Thank you for introducing me to Juan Tamariz. But he has this thing of appearing to be very excited. He's talking a mile a minute, and he's working cards. It always knocks me out of looking at him that cards are flying all over the place. Can you? Is that something you do? I get it. I thought that was wonderful. He would. People standing there waiting to be the, you know, being the straight person. They're waiting for their card, and here the cards are flying out of his hands, and they're trying to catch them. What? A lot of people do that trick.
You know, it's funny, Phil, and I think it's all about character. So let's say you're an actor and you want to be that handsome guy and you want to be that lady, the one that, you know, the big star. But you may not be that way. You might be more the Charlie Chaplin type or more the comedian type. It doesn't matter how hard you try to be that leading man, you're always going to be that kind of goofy character. Yeah. So it's about embracing the character who you are.
Yeah, but that particular thing, I mean, he's setting it up, but he, you know, you have to have, you know, certain number of cards in the deck, and you're going to be doing.
There are times when, oh, I accidentally dropped the cards.
Yes.
But perhaps on the floor, there's something that you really need to.
It is a great treat. By the way, he wrote books, but you say that, and he wrote books for children. He did the whole. He really. When did he sleep? Tell us about the books and what people might, if they want to read something by him or about him, what should they do?
So I would really recommend, actually, there is one magic store in Toronto. And if you want to get into magic, there is one store called The Browser's Den, and it's a wonderful store. It's in a mall, and it's up, and I have the address here.
Yeah.
I'll bring it up for you. I'll announce it later. But
take a card, any card.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Okay, yeah. So it's called The Browser's Den. You can search it online. And it's one of the last brick-and-mortar stores, but it's inside a mall. And you can go in. The reason why I say I would recommend to go to a magic store is that the person there, he's been involved with magic for 30 years. It's one of the last stores in Toronto, actually one of the last stores in Canada. He's been doing magic for 30 years. So if you go in there, he'll be able to eye you up and sort of say, okay, I think this is where you are. This is what you're, this is your, try this trick, try that trick, try this book. But in with Juan Tamariz, you know, his first book in English that was translated was called The 5 Points in Magic. That talks about how we can communicate with the audience with our eyes, with our hands, with our body, with our voice, mm-hmm. with our feet, and how we communicate and the ways and techniques you can use to communicate that way. Mm-hmm. Other of his books are very, very advanced card magic, but it's mostly he's constantly dealing with things about how to be natural, how to use your skills. But he also has a wonderful series on memorized deck magic. So if you'd like to challenge yourself, if you'd like to learn how to memorize a deck of cards, every single card in the deck, he has wonderful works on that. And that is
such a... We're in the age of gambling. There's a lot of people thinking about that.
Yeah. But a lot of his influence on other magicians, they have produced great work as well. Danny Daurtiz, Woody Aragon, and then some of his other contemporaries, Pepe Carroll, Arturo de Escanio, are some Spanish, they call them the Spanish Armada or the Spanish School.
That's interesting. They call them the Spanish Armada.
Well, foreigners call them the Spanish Armada. They call themselves magicians, magos.
So the tradition is going, so there's a lot of people probably built themselves, modeled themselves on him.
They tried. You know, it's such a, anyone who has tried realize that you're going to fail because it's sort of, the audience will realize you're not being authentic. You're being someone else. So it's, you can absolutely use his techniques and tricks, but you want to absorb them into yourself and then create them and express yourself using his types of, like, for example, you were talking about humor. So he mentions about how humor and where you want to place the humor within the trick. So at the mm-hmm. beginning of the trick, you can start off and have some fun and do some gags. But if you use humor as the climax is coming up to where this trick is going to be, the audience might relax and you're losing that tension that the audience that you've built up to come to this big finale.
Well, one of the ways that magicians, if I'm right, I'm asking you, that they build tension is that they periodically appear that they themselves are confused or say, oh, isn't that the card? And the guy says, no, it's not the card. And so the anxiety of the audience grows, and then, of course, it ends with the card is found where nobody expected it to be. Well, we've been talking to Pedro Parkero, and Parkero, P-A-R-K-O, K-E-R-O, .com, a practitioner, and we've learned something about Juan Tamariz. Thank goodness we are learning of him, because the world will have now is without him, and but his books are there and his career. Pedro, thanks very much.
You're very welcome. So just one more thing. At that place I was mentioning about, if you'd like to visit a magic store, and I'm not involved in the magic store at all, but I just...
You're not getting any percentage out of this. Yes.
I just think, you know, in talking about different things, about how so many people ask me that question, is there a school about magic? How do you learn about magic? What can you... And many of the recommendations, you can simply go to a public library and pick out a magic book and read. But the school, the store I'm talking about, it's called the Browser's Den of Magic, 2900 Steeles Avenue. That's at Steeles and 404. But if you go into that place, I think they was only 3 or 4 days a week they're open.
Yeah, the beauty there is the guy can talk to you about it and help you understand, right? And guide you.
Exactly. It's such a fun experience. But thank you, Phil. And again, I like just to say again, part of the community radio station is we can express different things and we put out the words to the community. And I appreciate the respect of the art of magic, getting the word out into the community.
Well, thank you very much. I know as a kid, I mean, that magic shows knocked me out. And I think every kid goes through a moment where he gets a... put a jacket on, puts cards in the sleeve, and thinks he can impress his relatives.
As long as they don't see you do it.
Pardon me?
As long as they don't see you do it.
Yeah. Well, I think we have, a minute to go, or are we done?
Yep, Phil, it's 2 minutes, 1 minute, whatever you like.
1 minute, okay. Well, I'll just say, again, it's Labor Day, and we played Solidarity Forever, and I did say that to Phil Conlon, who was giving us a live report from the street, that the old expression, the union makes us strong, you can turn that around and we make the union strong. And the labor movement needs to be much more involved with its members and making sure that any heated issue, I think even the OFL should talk about, like the SEIU strike that has been going on a long time, very tough. Why don't they call a special meeting and say, let's bring everybody together, representative, and we're going to back these people. Let's actually make solidarity something other than a nice song. And if you don't have members on gosh, as they say, then you're in trouble. So it's the Taylor Report, and 33-45-78 is coming up, and it's always great. And we'll see you next week.